Free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see our past shows and links to those archived presentations. Today is October 22nd, 2007. We have as our guest today, Tom Kasmer of Hydrastor, I guess is how you pronounce it. It's an infinitely variable hydraulic system that can be retrofitted into any electric or any vehicle, turning it into a hybrid vehicle, basically, super efficient, doubling or tripling the mileage and drastically cutting emissions. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sterling. I'm glad
you're
here.
Over on Eastern Time Zone there, and you've had a lot of coverage on the internet in the last many years that you've been involved in this. And what we'd like to do is basically talk first about what your technology is and then how far along it is and a lot of questions in between. So let's start out with what is the Hydrastor?
The Hydrastor is an improvement on the original dual pressure balanced hydraulic vane pump invented by Harry F. Vickers in 1925. And in that pump, Harry Vickers came up with a means to balance offset pressure in chambers, which had, before that time, created very huge bearing loads and limited lifetime for the two-chamber hydraulic devices, which are non-balanced.
This is a hydraulic system.
It's a pump. Similar to what you might have on the power steering in your car, if you were to take it apart. There's an elliptical chamber which guides the motion of vane tips, which move in and out twice per revolution. A total of four times per revolution, two in and two out. And the elliptical chamber, called the cam ring, was something which did not change. It was a fixed displacement unit. And there have been hydraulic motors and pumps made with this technology since the late 20s and on up to today. What they have managed to achieve with that technology is a pump or motor with an efficiency in the high 80s%. And there are limits to the amount of pressure and speed that these devices will go at. What I did was to eliminate the elliptical-shaped cam ring and replace that with a concentric nesting of endless metal belts, if you will, a flexible belt, which is very long-lived and very strong, which went around the tips of the vanes, and the historical friction of the vane tips against the cam ring now served as a driving means to cause the belt to rotate at almost the same speed as the rotor and vanes. And I located four cupped surface shaping pistons at 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 and 9 o'clock, like the face of a clock. And these pistons rode on the outside of the belt surface. And due to the motion, there was the continuous creation of a hydrodynamic bearing, which prevented metal-on-metal contact. So that my first model, which was built in 1996 and was tested at Tecumseh Test Lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan, achieved an overall efficiency, including fluid loss, of 94.7%. And that was witnessed by Mr. Bill Collins, who was the former chief engineer of Pontiac, who was trying to help me get this technology into the mainstream. Sterling, I would stop at any time if you have questions you want to pose or anybody else does, so...
Sure, yeah, we might mention for anyone who is listening in live We do have some call-in numbers on our website at freeenergynow.net, and I do prefer to have the questions come in toward the end. But you're doing great, giving us an overview of what this is and how it works. One question I would like to ask, kind of off the bat, we've actually had two similar shows in the last 2 months on related technologies, and perhaps you're familiar with these other two, and I would be curious to get your comparison, how you would compare what you're doing with these other two technologies. They are also contenders for the X Prize, which you're also a contender for, this 100-plus mile per gallon prize that's going to be coming up. That will be awarded to the most efficient vehicle that is demonstrated in that contest. The first one that we interviewed was on August 2nd, Ingo Valentin of Valentin Technologies, hydrostatic powertrain, 130 mile per gallon car, is a similar technology to yours. Another one is Cyrus Irani of High Kinesis. We interviewed him on September 17th. The power beam hybrid system increases vehicular efficiency by 100% or more, etc. It's also similar to what you're doing, using hydraulic recouping of the regenerative braking, basically, so that you can then turn that back into acceleration and improve the vehicle's performance significantly as a retrofit to existing vehicles. Are you familiar with those two systems?
I've heard of them. I have not studied them. I'll make it a point to do that.
Yeah, after the show, I'll send you a link to those, and you can add that to your repertoire of your competition. Because from what I can gather from my interviews with them, they also have some very good systems, and you've got some good, some tough competition that you'll be up against for that competition, the X Prize.
Well, I haven't seen my smoke yet.
Well, talking to Jim Dunn, who's a good friend and associate of mine, he's an advisor for the New Energy Congress, also an acquaintance of yours, certainly speaks up what you have and has been trying to get me to cover this for a long time, and I'm finally getting around to it. So there are a lot of people who certainly are very positive and speak highly of what you're accomplishing here. One of the things I'd like to wrap our heads around a little bit here is, how far along are you in the process of getting this to market?
Well, I just finished a design for a major construction equipment company, and I guess I better not say names, because I have a non-disclosure agreement. But that's been completed. I'm anticipating an efficiency of about 98% with that device as a pump on a standalone basis. And in fact,
would that be part of the vehicular system, or is that a separate?
Well, it's an example of the technology. It's not dedicated to vehicles as such. Let me take a moment to explain my my evolution in thinking about this whole situation. At one point in time, I thought of using kinetic flywheels only. And a friend of mine who was an engineer at Ford and Transmissions and Engines convinced me of the accumulator business, you know, storing energy and pressure means. And I even see a practical way to combine the two situations, which I'll get into later. What I came to realize is that if I could design and build a torque converter based on the hydristor concept, and that would be a packaging of two hydristors within the form factor of a typical torque converter or clutch that goes into a vehicle bell housing, I'd have a real chance at retrofitting everything on the road.
Mm-hmm.
All the other efforts, and I can't speak to the two you mentioned, I wonder if they are able to do the same.
As one far of them as fitting. Is a retrofit. The High Kinesis is a retrofit design, and it is actually a flywheel design. And the other one is a hydraulic design, and I believe that theirs is really designed to be from a ground up. Whereas yours is kind of like a combination of the best of the two designs, but yours is a retrofit hydraulic design.
The way I tried to approach this is, if I had my Cadillac Escalade or my Lincoln Navigator or my Dodge Ram or my Toyota Tundra, I'd like to be able to drive into a repair shop or a transmission shop or the dealer and have them yank out the existing transmission and torque converter, scrapping all the internal parts of the transmission because they're no longer needed, and replacing the torque converter with the hydrister torque converter, which does not rotate, and supplying a through shaft in the empty transmission case, saving only the speedometer gear and possibly the parking mechanism. So reinstalling this with the now empty transmission case, which on retrofit serves to hold up the engine and might even provide some space for localized hydraulic energy storage in the form of a bladder-controlled space in there, you know, a high-pressure tank that could fit in the space of the transmission. Anyhow, what this would do is give me something that would allow me to cycle the engine of the vehicle on and off to keep the tank charged up. And I would also charge up the tank whenever I was going down a hill or I was braking to a stop. And I believe the hydrister torque converter that I'm working on is actually going to be in the range of 97% overall efficiency, which is the sum of two units in hydraulic series. And I've had a lot of argument out of some of the automotive guys about the leakage in direct drive. What you have to realize here is that if you can shut the engine off and go a ways, you're really going to drastically improve the fuel economy of a vehicle and also drastically lower the CO2 emissions.
So you would be, when you say turn the engine off and drive a ways, you're talking about driving on the power of the hydraulic pressure that's been stored.
Yes.
And
so the idea is when the pressure in the tank drops below a certain number, the hydrister can efficiently restart the engine, like popping the clutch, but in a very efficient manner. It simply ratios the engine back up to speed, and you turn on the engine's ignition. So it runs a while and pumps up the tank to the high limit, or not necessarily the high limit, to some middle limit, because you got to leave some headroom for braking or going down hills. And you would then be able to cycle the engine on and off, whose function is simply to keep the tank charged up. So the engine would no longer drive the car. It's kind of like if anybody's ever had the experience of being almost out of gas and having to reach a gas station 5 or 6 miles away or 20 miles away. I've done this a few times. You get some speed up in the vehicle, and you shut the engine off and put it in neutral and coastal ways. You can go about twice as far on a gallon of fuel that way. That's really what this is. It converts any existing vehicle into a completely self-sustaining full hydraulic hybrid. And the result is a doubling or tripling of fuel economy while at least quartering the CO2 existing emissions. And I use the word existing for good reason. We have hundreds of millions of vehicles on the roads in the United States. There's probably 1 billion vehicles on the road worldwide. If we could take all those existing vehicles that are already on the road and people have paid for and they're using, and most of them like the vehicle they have, they like a big Hummer or whatever they want to drive, okay? It's just the way people are. It's called the market. If we could change all those vehicles over to the hydrister technology, turning them all into full hydraulic hybrids, number one, any vehicle with a hydrister hydraulic hybrid drive system becomes a screamer off the the stoplight, because you can literally pull up to a traffic light, hold up a $100 bill, and get a nod from the super sports car guy next to you in the lane. When the light changes, of course, you reach over and turn off the ignition, shutting the motor off, and you can blaze up to 60 at the coefficient of friction of limit of 1 in an all-wheel drive vehicle and get there in under 3 seconds. And this is true of diesels as well. So along with the hydristor technology comes blazing performance. Engine longevity is increased commensurately 3 to 4 times. So getting a 500,000 miles on your engine now is not all that amazing. Your maintenance costs go down because you're not going to be changing oil or putting plugs in or that sort of thing near as often. You're going to stretch that out 3, 4, 5 times to what you do now. And, of course, your brakes don't wear out, so you probably will have the same set of brakes for several hundred thousand miles, maybe even pushing a 500,000 miles. And it goes on and on.
Now, in doing the conversion, of course, we're talking about some expense here because you're carrying into some... I know when you're talking about doing a transmission overhaul, you're $2,000 to $3,000. Of course, this isn't a transmission overhaul, but it's still getting into that heavy duty mechanism. How much money are we talking about to do a retrofit conversion?
My goal at the bottom end of the retrofit is $3,000 to $3,500 at the customer level.
Mm-hmm.
And because the hydristor is designed to fit within the historical bell housing. Let me just make a point here. I saw a History Channel movie on Henry Ford, and they said he had a one-time opportunity in history with the production line, the mass production line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel I have a one-time opportunity in history because, if you will, the hydristor owns the bell housing space and everything on the road. And the hydristor is a technology that likes to be larger in diameter and thinner, so it lends itself very nicely to being a torque converter or even a clutch. I mean, I can replace a clutch and pressure plate in a standard shift vehicle, and you can just leave the transmission as is. In fact, if you want to go a step further, I can have a his and her vehicle, if you will, which has a switch on the dash, where one position is automatic and the other is clutch and stick shift. I don't know if the other guys can do these things.
Now, when you talk about front-wheel drive, those things are really compact. You're saying you'd be able to fit this hydristor into the front-wheel transmission space?
No, the bell housing space. They all have torque converters or clutch and pressure plates. Every vehicle on the road, except for some of the new hybrids, which are not going to be able to be worked with. So, I mean, maybe, but I'd have to look at them first.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, whether it's a front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, or all-wheel drive, the hydristor technology would simply make it a hybrid vehicle which outperforms, in my opinion, the existing hybrid stuff already on the road or contemplated in the next few years.
What about the complexity of the wide diversity of vehicles? There's so many makes and models and years. Is that going to be a problem in terms of coming up with, you know, deciding which size of the hydristor to put in the vehicle and how to convert it?
The beauty of the hydristor is that I'm planning on designing and manufacturing 4 or 5 or 6 basic hydristor sizes. So the little one would fit into an early Volkswagen Beetle, let's say, and the really big one would go into a Hummer or a 2.5-ton truck. And the way you do this is you have adapters to make the common standard hydristor fit in anybody's vehicle. This could really realistically be done by the backyard mechanic doing this with the car up on ramps if they know how to drop the transmission and change it.
When, you're talking earlier about $3,000 to $3,500 for retrofit, that includes the price of the hydrostor. That's not just the installation,
yeah,
correct?
The hydrostor and the adapter is required to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you see as the return on investment for people buying that system?
Well, at the price of gas, they should pay for their hydrostor easily in a year. And, of course, this will in turn serve to drive the price of gas down, won't it?
Have you had any luck talking to automobile manufacturers to actually implement this off the block?
I laugh for good reason.
I'm sure.
I could even use some words that probably shouldn't be said on air. Well, you can see the problem here. For example, I'm aware that Ford and General Motors jointly invested $500 million in a six-speed automatic transmission for front-wheel drives that are going to be used between both corporate vehicles. Now, that doesn't just mean $500 million that's been spent. That means a production system which is stretched out over 3 or 4 or 5 years. You understand what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm.
So for them to drop what they're doing and adopt the hydrostor would cost $2 or $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to do it. Not only that, but everybody I've talked to wants to see me with a plethora of working models with years of test and on and on and on. My point is that I've got some realistic technology that actually has a promise of fixing these things. We don't have time. In fact, more importantly, our kids and especially our grandkids don't have time for us to sit around while we go through the show-me business, which is why I'm in the XPRIZE contest, because I intend to win it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm going to be using hydrostor technology for more than just driving the car. I'm going to be using a form of the hydrostor, which I've got a patent on in both the U.S. and most of Europe. I've got a super freon heat pump that I'm developing using a hydrostor where I get a gain or a return of 10 times instead of the historical 3 times. And by using that device, I can now, with a kilowatt of energy, harness or harvest 10 kilowatts of low-grade heat, which I can send over to a Stirling engine whose output drives a generator or a pump or whatever, and some of the energy is tapped off to be self-sustaining, and the rest of it goes to charge a battery or pump up a accumulator tank or whatever. So I'm planning on tapping into the exhaust heat, the radiator coolant heat, and even the air temperature under hood to scavenge additional energy out of a gallon of fuel. I'm planning, my target on the XPRIZE is to capture 80% of the energy in a gallon of fuel. As well as
For the listeners' frame of reference, the best engines nowadays, the efficiency of converting the energy that's in the petrol into motion is 34% ballpark, and you're saying you could get that up to 80%.
Sure, most of it is in the form of heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've got hydrostor technology, which very nicely can scavenge heat loss and turn it into useful work I can do something with, as I say, charge batteries or charge up hydraulic pressure tanks. So what happens is, if the engine is doing these extra things and getting more energy out of a gallon of fuel, it's going to run less often.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to make less heat. I mean, the whole thing will net out in the end. And the beauty of it is, my technology is directly usable in mass production. And that's one of the requirements of the XPRIZE. It's not enough to make a 130-mile-per-gallon car. It's something that you can actually put into realistic production.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else is faced with a whole new ball game, whereas I'm after the old ball game. And eventually,
you're able to take the existing infrastructure of vehicles that are on the road right now and convert them into highly efficient systems that can save money, gas, and lower emissions dramatically.
Right. That's the idea. That's the approach. And the hydrister, as far as I know, is the only technology which actually has the ability to do that. By the way, I mentioned the heat pump system. I'm also going after an undersea or underwater heat exchanger system as a local generation system.
Mm-hmm.
If you could put hydrister heat exchangers several hundred yards offshore under the ocean, you could tap into the excess heat in the ocean, which is caused by global warming, and convert that into usable electricity with no emissions and no fuel. And in the process, you could help drop the temperature of the oceans. So with that, you could afford to shut down presently air-burning coal, oil, and natural gas power generation for a further reduction in CO2. What I'm all about here is trying to solve the energy crisis and the global warming crisis at the same time. And believe me, this has been a long, long road for me to get here, to this realization. And it's all been by hard work and then thousands of hours of looking and thinking on my part.
Now, on this system you're talking about, this energy generation system using the heat difference in the ocean versus ambient air, obviously that is a technology that would work. The question is feasibility in terms of the price that would be involved in setting up such a system. Or do you think you could be competitive with the present price of a coal-fired plant?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And another thing I
want to... How far along are you in the implementation of that design?
I'm not very far. You have to realize that I'm just one guy doing this. I've had no job for 17 years. I've dedicated my entire life to this. And that's why I've gotten to the things I have. I've stayed out of the books. I don't want to know what somebody else is doing because I don't want to be influenced by it. I want to look at things for what they are and try to understand them and try to figure out how to utilize them. I mean, that's the way I've approached all this.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got a lot of books, any of it.
Let's talk about that for a minute, the aspect when you say that you're just one person. In order to bring this step forward, obviously, there's going to need to be a business wrapped around you. You're going to need to have some lawyer expertise. You're going to need to have some marketing expertise and some engineering expertise. And it's going to take many people to make this work. Would you consider yourself a good team player to be able to wrap a team around yourself as you get the money that you need to move this stuff forward?
Absolutely. I think I know when to bring the team in. And in the meantime, trying to assemble a team, which is, I believe, the mistake a lot of people make in development. They try to bring a massive team together with a business plan and all that sort of thing initially. I think I'm at the point where my technology is ready to make that step.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I want to do is I want to go after the XPRIZE vehemently. And this is going to demonstrate the technology to the public.
Well, the XPRIZE is 2-3 years off in terms of its it isn't the actual... Like the deadline is 2008, and the actual race is when is that going to happen?
Well, there are going to be periodic events throughout that time period.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that's still a ways off in terms of fruition. When you say you're at the point where you're ready to take the step of bringing in a team, are you talking in the next few weeks, months, years? What kind of time frame are you looking at?
Months.
Mm-hmm.
I expect to have initially a team in the second quarter of 2008. And by the way, I just completed a deal on a hydrister drive for electric scooters to be marketed in Asia, all of it.
Huh.
And I've created a 4x4x4-inch cube hydrister with a little bell crank arm on it to control ratio. And it's going to go between the electric motor on an electric scooter, battery-driven, and the wheel. And the normal reaction is, well, you're introducing more inefficiency in the driveline. Well, that's where people have a lot of things wrong. To start out from a standstill with an electric motor, it basically is the highest load on the motor. In order to get torque, you have to push current in the motor. And the motor is not turning, so it doesn't have any generator action or counter EMF.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just plunk the battery across the motor, you'd have all kinds of current, and you'd be doing wheel stands. So they introduce, in the more expensive units, what's called a pulse width modulation controller electronically, or they might just put a series of resistors in series with the battery and the motor to limit the current. Well, all these various control means and this direct connection of the motor to the wheel are the most inefficient way to do this. With a hydrister, you would start out with the motor coming up to several thousand RPM under essentially no load, and the initial ratio to the rear wheel would be thousands or tens of thousands to one. So the motor would even see a load as you started to wind up the rubber on the scooter wheel and started to raise the front wheel off the ground.
You really take off.
Oh, yeah. But the battery doesn't even see a load.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to be able to, on this scooter, roll the throttle over center. And the hydrister speeds up the motor during braking, and it becomes a regeneration braking device. I'm anticipating that this is going to double the range of scooters, and it is retrofittable onto the scooter, two- and three-wheel scooters that are used all over Asia. You see them in movies about Bangkok, Thailand, or something, where somebody is running around in a cab with a driver which has a seat in the back, and it's a three-wheel, bicycle-wheel scooter. And the market is 2.5 billion people, so I think it's going to really make a name for the hydrister. And as part of my contract, I'm requiring that the name Powered by Hydrister go on the side of the vehicle that's converted or built from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll make a separate statement about what's going on here.
The Intel Inside branding. Now, yeah, that's a huge market, and I know over in Asia, scooters and electric bicycles are the rage. It's not just a matter of economy. It's actually a fashion statement over there.
The narrow streets and all the traffic, you can get a lot more people on scooters down a street than you can Hummers.
Mm-hmm.
Or Cadillac Escalades or what have you.
Now, when we talk about the starting out and stopping and, you know, pulling out of the garage is where this question is headed. With a flywheel, obviously, you know, a flywheel is a similar concept. That's one of these technologies I mentioned earlier that is similar to what you're designing, which is a retrofit. This high kinesis is a flywheel. But flywheels are not going to stay running, whereas a hydraulic, what is the storage capacity of a hydraulic in terms of over time? If this thing sat in a garage for 4 months, is it still going to have the same kick as it would if you pulled out the next day? Or how much loss is there in a hydraulic pressurized system?
Let me answer that by presenting another aspect of what I'm going to do in the XPRIZE and how this is going to solve many, many problems. One of the hydraulics companies got into a retrofit hydraulic system that goes in the drive shaft. And there was a 10-gallon accumulator with a rubber bladder in it to separate the nitrogen gas from the hydraulic fluid. And even that doesn't work all that well because at high pressure, the gas will infiltrate through the membrane. But that said, the 10 gallons gets compressed down to about the size of a coffee cup, or roughly 7 cubic inches at 5,000 psi pressure. And there's enough energy in that to accelerate a 7,000-pound large vehicle from standstill to 70 miles an hour. Now, I say to myself, well, there are some guys in France, and now I'm aware of the technology going into India, that are using compressed air for cars.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, the hydrister is just a pump. They could pump fluids or gases. So I am changing my design on the retrofit to add a third element, which is strictly an air pump. And it's going to pump up a 10-gallon air tank, which takes up the same space, weighs less because you don't have any oil in it, and then you don't have to have an additional 10-gallon tank as a reservoir to provide the oil to shove into the pressure tank. And if you want to use up all the space that you had room for, which is 20 gallons, you can store 660 times the energy that you can with the hydraulic system they built. Now that, to me, is charging the tank up, which might take a while because of the size of it, but you could shut the engine off and drive for 40 or 50 miles with no motor running. You could also go down the biggest gravitational drop in Colorado and save all the energy of the downhill. So all you got to do is put in a fairly leak-proof shutoff valve, which is what I intend to add in the system, and store these pressures. I mean, they'd be there for years. So that gives you another means to start the engine. You can start it off the pressure in the tanks.
And how that is an interesting aspect. I'm wondering, in terms of the storage losses, where you've got this compressed air or you've got the compressed hydraulic fluid, how much loss do you have over time? I would imagine.
Well, what's going to happen is first of all, with my system, I'm going to use the atmosphere as a reservoir. It's called, I draw in air just like I do on the engine, now I burn it. But in my case, what I'm going to do is compress it in a tank and save it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get hot. There will be a what's called an adiabatic loss of energy. But when I compare that to having to drag on the brakes all the time to slow the vehicle down because there's not enough headroom in the hydraulic system to store the energy, I'm way ahead of the game. That's going to be another aspect of the XPRIZE. I'm going to store hydraulic and pneumatic pressures.
Mm-hmm.
Again, all of which is going to be retrofittable.
Yeah, maybe you're not understanding my question. What I'm trying to get at here is when you have a capacitor and you put a bunch of electricity into a capacitor, if you unload that capacitor right away, you've got you don't lose hardly anything. But if you let that capacitor sit, it loses that charge pretty fast. It's not a very good longevity storage system. What I'm wondering is, what is the longevity of the storage of the compressed air and of the compressed hydraulic fluid?
Well, regarding the compressed hydraulic fluid, which is, again, in the form of a compressed gas, because the fluid itself is incompressible, more or less. In the case of the hydraulic system, you will eventually get a kind of an osmosis of the pressure of the gas molecules through the membrane into the oil, and it fills the oil up with with gas all over the volume of the oil and becomes spongy. With the pneumatic system, provided you have a leak-proof shutoff valve, it's going to sit there forever. There is no mechanism. Once you've lost the energy from cooling down the compressed gas, and I haven't done those numbers, but it doesn't seem to me it's more than 10 or 15% of the energy you put in there. Once that happens and the gas cools down to room temperature or ambient temperature, that's it. It's going to sit there and wait, which to me is a superior system.
When you talk about these compressed air tanks, you know, the XPRIZE is something that needs to be commercially implementable. So this is something that you are not only expecting to put in the XPRIZE vehicle, but also something that would be commercially feasible. Where in a typical vehicle would you be installing the air tanks?
Well, you'd have tanks made from materials that wouldn't rust. Maybe there's some high-tech plastic that would do the job. I know a few of the companies are working in those areas. But the point is, if you put a car up on a lift, there's generally all sorts of space all over the place underneath the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So you could package an array of tanks of various sizes with reliable hoses. And the hoses could be metal lines, and that eliminates any leakage through the rubber of the hose or whatever. And as I say, a 20-gallon system gives you a storage of one coffee cup. So it wouldn't take much in the way of a 1 or 2 or 3 gallon pneumatic system to give you lots of energy storage at 5,000 PSI. And by the way, the hydrister technology I'm working on, I've designed it to operate at 10,000 PSI. Also, because of the fact that the belt encircles the vein tips, there's a centripetal force of the veins, which limits conventional vein technology to the range of 5 or 6,000 RPM. Because of the belt surrounding the vein tips, all of the combined centripetal force is fully contained by the belt and rotates with it. So the hydrister can really go to substantially higher speeds by design. For example, I could see putting a hydrister directly on the shaft of a jet engine operating at 23,000 RPM. Running a vehicle, or running the hydraulic system, running the three-phase 400 hertz power, the fuel pump for the engine, and gear down systems, which go to axial piston swashpipe pumps and motors. They run generators, will be replaced by a direct hydrister, saving weight, reducing parts, increasing the mean time to failure calculations, and all the rest of that.
Let's talk about safety for a second.
Okay.
If you have a rupture of a pressure tank in an accident, which is going to happen, what kind of issues are we talking about? Is it shrapnel or?
I wouldn't think there'd be any shrapnel involved. The tank would just burst the seam, and the pressure would burst, come out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's any worse than a gas tank exploding and catching fire, or a supercapacitor having an internal failure and dumping all the energy into itself and blowing up. Or some of the exotic batteries. I don't think the amount of danger is even as high with pressure tanks.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a number of patents involved here. For international rollout, obviously you can't patent every single country.
No.
What does your international patent protection portfolio look like?
Well, basically, it's the heat pump generator system. I did not have the means to get the original patents funded for the European markets, the foreign markets. But the way I see it, I'm patenting ahead of what's out there. In other words, I'm in the process right now of filing a fifth provisional patent, and I've got a fourth patent shortly to issue. And I think I will be getting some financing means, so patent number four can be extended to the entire worldwide community under the GATT treaty with money.
Mm-hmm.
And patent number five, which contains the latest secret stuff, I've got at least 3 years of time before I have to even file those countries. So in other words, the patents that are out there are the old technology. And I realize people are going to just use them without any consideration. And that's okay. What I'm trying to do is change the paradigm of how energy is created and used.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question that I have for you, considering how much coverage you have received, you know, you've had substantial coverage back in 2004, 2005, 2006. Here we are in 2007. Why do you think it is that you're not maybe further along than what you would like to be? What's the logjam? What's holding things up?
Oh, dear. Well, none of this is easy. What I have today is quite a bit different than what I had 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's substantially more mature in its technology, and I've had to do all the work. I've also had no personal money to work with, so people have been donating to me or trying to invest in my technology, and I'm still here, and I got this far.
Mm-hmm.
I've managed to raise, I would say $150,000 for the patents so far. It took a lot of work. I spend, on average, half my week trying to find somebody to help me with some financial problem or another. If I was able to get a philanthropic donor to come in and give me an influx of even a modest amount of cash, I could make this thing fly much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, I've got to make sure I have insurance on the car, I've got to feed my family, pay the mortgage, keep the electricity on, and all those things, when you have no income, tend to be really a white-knuckle sort of a affair.
Mm-hmm.
Another problem has been technology in terms of software. I was given the grant of an IBM machine back in 1997, along with the use of a software called CATIA, and I've learned how to use that. Problem is, because of the cutbacks at IBM and Dassault Systems, the owners of CATIA, I've not been able to get any upgrades in the technology. So I've had a struggle with the old stuff, which gets older and older by the day. I finally got some help from a new software company. I better not mention their name just yet until I check with them. But I'm in the 21st century with design software, and I can actually make models that a machine shop with CNC machinery can build, and I can even transmit the models by email connections to a shop thousands of miles away. So I've gained a great deal of capability in the struggle that I've been on.
How much prototyping have you been able to do in terms of building testable devices?
I built the John Deere four-wheel drive riding lawnmower. And by the way, that's another example of the hydrostatic technology. The drive on the John Deere is a differential hydrostatic drive. By that I mean is it has two inputs. There's an input from the forward reverse lever for speed, and there's a second input from the steering wheel. It is, in fact, the world's first hydraulic analog computer based on the laws of plane geometry. So using a sine function, I take the position of the steering wheel and the amount of forward or reverse speed I'm calling for, and I literally change the relationship internally in the hydristor in a specific manner so that I cause the outside wheels on the turn to go the correct amount faster, called for by the steering wheel position, and the inside wheels the correct amount slower, as if I had a solid axle and two differing tire diameters on the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ultimate traction system. You can see that on
John Deere. What other prototyping have you gotten?
Well, besides the scooter program, I've completed a major design for this construction equipment company. And I'm working on a drive for a snowmobile. And I'm also working on the heat pump electrical generator system. Those last two items are still in the almost to be cut stage, as far as the metal shops. I've just got to find a benefactor who will put up the money for me to cut the metal.
So let's talk for a second. We've not mentioned your website before. People can go for more information. Hydristor, HYDRISTOR.com. And where do people go if they're interested in investing? How does that work?
Well, there's contact information on my website. And by the way, if you do a Google search of the word Hydristor, you'll get several thousand entries, among them your show and your website,
mm-hmm.
for previous mentions that you made.
Yeah, I'm creating a feature page at PezWiki, and within 2-3 weeks, that'll probably be showing up close to the top at Google. We do pretty well on Google, so we'll be up there behind Wikipedia probably within 2-3 weeks.
By the way, there's one additional feature of the Hydristor I'd like to mention, if I may, before we conclude.
Sure, go ahead.
The Hydristor can do more than the job of, let's say, differentially driving a pair of axles. There are four chambers in the Hydristor. Chamber one is between the 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock position, assuming clockwise rotation. And chamber two is between 3 and 6, 3 between 6 and 9, etc. So if you had the pistons at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock pushed in, and the pistons at 6 and 12 o'clock backed out the same exact amount, and you had chamber 1 connected to a right-hand wheel motor whose return went to chamber 2, chamber 3 to a left-hand wheel motor and whose return went to chamber 4, you'd have your differential hydrostatic transaxle. Now, let's say you had this on an industrial tractor, and you're driving down a lumberyard aisle, and you've got to raise the bucket up to clear some lumber with your load. If you additionally move the 12 o'clock piston out beyond where it is to drive the tractor, and you allow fluid to come in chamber 4 through a one-way ball check valve from a reservoir, you're going to introduce additional fluid into chamber 1. Now, if you had a T connection in the line from chamber 1 to the right-hand wheel motor, and you opened up the third leg of the T to the lift cylinder on the tractor bucket for this short period of time, then the additional oil you're putting into chamber 1, provided by chamber 4 and the action of the 12 o'clock piston, would result in raising the bucket in a hydrostatic manner. And there would be no change in the drive of the right-hand wheel motor, because if, let's say, the wheel motor was taking 500 PSI drop to roll along, if the pressure jumped to 1,000 PSI because of the loading of the bucket, you know, whatever weight was on it, then that would put 1,000 PSI on the inlet of the hydraulic motor. However, it's only dropping 500 PSI, so that, in turn, propagates through the remaining 500 PSI trying to go in the inlet port of chamber 2, and you simply have a 500 PSI back pressure, and the right-hand motor keeps on trucking. Bottom line is the hydrister can do theoretically up to 10 jobs, each of which are separate and hydrostatically controllable, using a common fluid. You can do what I said with chambers 1, 2, 3, and 4 separately with tricky kind of connections. You can then play chamber 1 against 2, 1 against 3, 1 against 4, 2 against 3, 2 against 4, and 3 against 4, in addition to driving the wheels. And you have theoretically up to 10 possible jobs a hydrister can do. I don't think anybody else can do that. So one hydrister replaces a half a dozen or a dozen pumps on a system.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate you coming on the show. We're come to the end of our time here today. We've been talking with Tom Kasmer from Hydrister and the technology that will enable the conversion of regular vehicles to run on a highly efficient hydraulic, to turn into a highly efficient hydraulic hybrid, to double or triple the mileage and drastically cut by a quarter their emissions, among many other applications of the technology. In its early stages of development, but we're expecting rollout with different systems, as we talked about on the show. And again, thank you, Tom.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
You're certainly welcome.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Your Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.